I invite you to open your Bible to the book of Ruth, and we really get going in our study of this well-known Old Testament book. Last week, I gave you eight reasons, I think, that we should study the book of Ruth. I probably neglected the real reason, number nine. It's because I wanted to do Ruth, because I just did Judges, and you don't have to do so much page turning, and you know I cramp up real easy. So, you know, I mean, I had all my Judges books out in my study, and there's Ruth just kind of staring at me, saying, "What about me? What do you got against the girls?" So Deborah wasn't enough. We got to do Ruth. And like I said last time, this is where the sunrise comes after the darkness of the book of Judges. And so chapter one is our mission today, and I want to tackle it as a whole because I think its message is unified. The book of Ruth is divided in our English Bibles into four chapters, and that pretty much coordinates with the four acts that take up the story of Ruth, one of the most famous romance and love stories in all of literature, one that has obviously endured for thousands of years with its famous and poignant story of tragedy and then triumph and how God uses that to accomplish his greater purposes. It's really something to look at this book next to the book of Judges because of that darkness and because of the brightness of Ruth. And it would be that way because as the book opens, it says, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed, that there was a famine in the land." And so continuing on the theme from the book of Judges, Ruth opens up and tells us an unforgettable story, a story that has so much to teach us. And so let's jump into chapter one. If I had to give this chapter a title, I would, and I do, it's a rule, I would call it "The Lord Takes and Gives." The Lord takes and gives. This act could be divided into three scenes. Let me just read to you the first scene. It takes place in verses 1-5 and sets the story up. "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed, that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left alone with her two sons. And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband." The book of Ruth opens with a heart-wrenching scene. Everybody dies. It's a tough opening to a romantic story, to see not only death, but famine and pestilence or whatever it was that caused the land to be forsaken in those days. You understand that this paragraph sets us up with the theology that's going to follow, that according to Naomi, God is in this. She sees his hand in it, and she'll explain that to us in time. But we have to begin by acknowledging the loss here. The loss in the first chapter of Ruth is that this takes place in a day where loss was commonplace. Remember, no one knows the book of Judges better than you guys, at least not most folks in churches today. We labored there. So you get it. The cycle of despair and sin and judgment, that's what we've seen in the book of Judges, and that is the same place we're at in the book of Ruth. And that cycle of despair, we don't know exactly where Ruth fits in. Some people think it was during the reign of Gideon. It's just a guess. It doesn't matter. It's the days of the judges, and these are dark and distressing and difficult days. And in those days, sometimes the land was distressed because of marauding Moabites. Other times it was distressed because of the Philistines. But whatever it was, times were so difficult in the land of Israel that no longer are we looking at a national story or a tribal story like in the book of Judges, but we're zoomed all the way in to this individual man, Elimelech, and his family, and how their lives would connect with God's greater plan. In the book of Judges, we saw tribal and national connections. In the book of Ruth, we see familial and individual ones. And I think this paragraph where we see the loss of a husband, the loss of a patriarch, and then just a few short years later, the loss of these two sons, a paragraph marked by tragedy and difficulty and death and sorrow, all in the backdrop of a spiritual, destitute land that's not honoring God, where men are doing what's right in their own eyes, according to the book of Judges. And on top of that, a famine that's at least localized to Israel, so much so that it's driving these people out like refugees as they seek greener pastures in Moab. You see all of this happening, and I'm reminded of what I often hear people say when they talk about the Bible. It's a phrase something like this: it was different then, but it was so different then. And what they're usually saying is my life isn't like Bible lives. My life isn't like that. I didn't see Jesus feed the 5,000. I've never seen an axe head float. I've never heard the voice of God audibly from heaven. And so we look at the Bible, and sometimes we're tempted to think it was different then. It was so different. It's not like that anymore. But then we meet the first paragraph of the book of Ruth, and it's a paragraph about God taking away. And we get that theologically. He takes away. Deuteronomy 32, 39, see now that I am he, God says, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there's none that can deliver out of my hand. Or 1 Samuel 2, 6, the Lord kills and brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and raises up. The Lord makes poor and makes rich. He brings low and exalts. Or Job, in so many ways a counterpoint to the book of Ruth. Job 1:21, he said, naked I come from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. But this story starts with taken away. And we say, it's so different then and now, but it's not different than this first paragraph. I think when you feel like you missed out on the miraculous, because you didn't live in Bible times, you misunderstand the nature of the full scope of redemptive history. Not very many people ever saw a miracle in God's economy. Old or New Testament, there wasn't so many people who saw these miraculous interventions when you compare that to the entirety of human history and even God's history in working with Israel. If you look at the miraculous events that occurred, there was usually and oftentimes long periods without anything of the sorts happening. They, like us, heard about those things. Some of them saw, but most of them did not. The vast majority of people, even those recorded for us in redemptive history, never heard the voice of God with their own ears. Certain generations saw God's miraculous working. But other generations, like this family that fled the famine in Israel, in Bethlehem, in Judah, and moved to Moab, didn't see an extraordinary miracle here. Elimelech died, verse 3. He was not confronted by a prophet and raised from the dead. If you haven't read the story, that's not what happens here. Mahlon and Chilion, the sons, these husbands, the ones who this family completely depended on, died. And in no miraculous moment did God come down and speak life into them so that they would live again. What I see in the taking of these three lives is the sovereign hand of God moving in a very ordinary way. And I think it's good for us to approach this text that way, because we remember that this is what life is like. Life consists of loss, of sorrow, of periods of our lives that are debilitating with difficulties. And that's what we see in this chapter. We don't see some kind of audible voice from heaven. We don't see some prophetic word coming down, being written on stone tablets. We don't see water parting. We don't see leprosy healed. We see men die. And this is what life is like east of the Garden of Eden. Sin has entered this world because of Adam and Eve, and our lives are marked by difficulty and pain and sorrow and loss. And a wise person who fears God recognizes, as Naomi will do, the hand of God in all of it. She didn't see a miraculous intervention. She didn't hear God speak directly to her. In fact, she somewhat mocks the miraculous concept of having another baby and then these ladies waiting around for him to grow up and then marry them again, kind of the natural kinsman redeemer, miraculous chia pet fast grow situation. It doesn't... You know what a chia pet is? Is that 80s or am I okay? Anyway, they grow fast. So it's ordinary, and that's what I want you to see. And I want you to see the hand of God in this because Naomi insists upon it, and she's not wrong. And so as this book opens, we see an ordinary circumstance that we are unable to completely interpret and say, this is why that happened. And lots of Bible teachers do that, and I can't do it because I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think it's there. I think this is the time of the judges because it says so, and I think there was a famine in the land, but I don't know why because the text doesn't tell me why. I do know God's behind a famine. God's behind a drought. God's behind a war. God's behind the end of a famine, the end of a drought, and the end of a war. I know that theologically, but the text doesn't tell me who's being punished or why. We can make assumptions and guesses, but it's not there. All we know is that there was a famine in the land. And then in this statement of irony in verse 2, a certain man of Bethlehem, a Hebrew word that you know because, you know, the nativity story, Bethlehem, it's a famous place. But the Hebrew name of the place is ironic because it means the house of bread. And when there's no bread in a house of bread, it's an interesting statement, right? You can also kind of monkey around with their names a little bit. Elimelech means my God is king. Naomi's name, which we'll see explained in a few minutes, means pleasant, but I'll tell you more about her name. But Mahlon and Chilion, nobody really parses their names because they die so quickly in the story. Main characters killed off real fast. One of their names could mean sickly, and the other one could mean shortly, which I think is I don't know if that's... I was monkeying with my Hebrew tools, and they're a little rusty. Whatever their names mean, the author only brings attention to Naomi's name and the irony there, but it's obvious that a place called Bethlehem was out of bread, and so these people look for a place where the grass was greener, and they go to Moab. Now, you could indict them for leaving the promised land, but the promised land wasn't very promising in those days. And for a family to move isn't necessarily a great sin against God. And so to interpret the death of these three men as God's punishment for leaving Israel, I think is going beyond what's written. They go to Moab, a place that was just south and east of Israel across the Dead Sea, that because of the microclimates of the area could have still had a good harvest and good potential. And so they see green grass, and literally they don't know, though the grass is greener on the other side, it will not be greener at all in their experience. It will be much, much worse. Irma Bombeck said, "The grass is always greener over a septic tank." It's true. And that seems to be what's happening here. They go to Moab, this foreign land, and they try to make it there because they weren't going to survive in Bethlehem, and Elimelech dies, perhaps arranging a marriage for his two sons with local women. And I don't want you to read too much into that either. The fact that they married Moabites according to Torah law is not prohibited. There are consequences to it. It's less than ideal, but it's not prohibited. Marrying Canaanites was prohibited. Marrying Moabites was not strictly prohibited. And so they arranged these marriages, and there would have been consequences in Israelite worship because of this kind of marital arrangement. The Moabites were not allowed to worship as the Israelites worshiped, nor were their children. And so it's a less than ideal situation, but this is a less than ideal circumstance. This is life in a fallen world. There's a famine on. They're in a foreign land. They would have been looked down upon. The fact that they were able to acquire wives for these young men was a good thing, because now the family name could be perpetuated. They could live together until the death of Elimelech. And even then, the text emphasizes that this story isn't about the patriarch. This story isn't about the sons. This story is about Naomi. It makes a switch once her husband dies, and Naomi becomes the character of focus in verse 3, and it says Naomi was left alone. It says it again in verse 5. My Bible says bereft of her two children, but in the Hebrew it's the same word, left alone. This mother suffers loss of her husband and then loss of her two sons. That pain would be indescribable. And this is what life is like in a fallen world, because sometimes these tragedies happen close together. Sometimes they come in waves, and that's what's happening here. And we're introduced to Orpah, the first Moabite wife, and Ruth, the second Moabite wife. And we picture 10 years of recovering from the loss of Elimelech, 10 years of these two men trying to establish this household and take care of an aging widow as well. And then somehow, apparently, suddenly, they both died. And Naomi was alone, left alone. Well, she wasn't totally alone, though, was she? She was worse than alone. She had not two sons to care for her, not a husband to provide for her, but in this ancient world, she had two liabilities, two Moabite widows. I mean, one widow in the time and period of Judges was bad enough. Three widows all linked together was a complete and epic disaster. Remember, in those days, to not have a husband meant that you were not protected, that you were susceptible to the questionable men of the book of Judges. We saw how badly that could go in those closing chapters of the book of Judges. It was a dangerous place and a dangerous time, and even the social care that God instituted for his people was not intact because of their disobedience to God's law. And so we have three impoverished, we have three susceptible, we have three endangered widows all linked together, and that takes us to the second scene of this first act, verses 6 through 19a. Let me read it to you. It says, "Then she," Naomi, "arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab. Before we go on, let me note the key word in this chapter is the word return or go back. It occurs 11 times. You'll see it in different versions of returning or going back or departing. That's the same word 11 times in the Hebrew text. I want your ear to catch it as I read verse 6 through verse 19a. It says, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab. For she had heard in the land of Moab that Yahweh had visited his people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, 'Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May Yahweh deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. And may the Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband.' And then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, 'No, but we will surely return with you to your people.' But Naomi said, 'Return, my daughters. Why should you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have tonight and also bear sons, would you wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it's harder for me than for you, for the hand of Yahweh has gone forth against me.' And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And then she said, 'Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back. Return to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law.' But Ruth said, 'Do not urge me to leave you or to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may Yahweh do to me, and worse if anything but death parts you and me.' And when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. And so they both went until they came to Bethlehem." Well, this second scene introduces us to that theme word I wanted your ear to hear: return, come back, return, go back, return, return, return. 11 times you heard the word, and it's in this turning of the story that we start to see that a conversation is taking place at a crossroads in the lives of these three widows. It's a moment of decision, a moment of great importance as they look at the options before them, which are severely limited, and they look at the basic issue of survival, and they start to weigh the cost and consider the consequences. And as they come to this point in their life, this crossroads of decision in their life, they have to decide what they're going to do, how they're going to survive, what their next move will be, and their options are severely limited. And it's this point where we're talking about returning and departing and turning so much that we start to see the weight of this story turn as well, because in that first scene, we saw God taking. And Naomi will interpret that for us quite effectively. God takes, and she knows that to be true. But in this next section, we start to see God give. And the verses I read you at the beginning, Deuteronomy 32:39, "I am he, there's no God besides me, I kill and I make alive, I wound and I heal, and there's none that can deliver out of my hands. Naked I came, Job said, naked I shall return. The Lord gave, the Lord's taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." As we often see in our ordinary lives, when God takes, God gives, and when God gives, God takes. And this highlights our dependency on him in this moment of crisis, in this moment of decision. These three widows look at each other and have a very serious conversation about who will return and who will go where. And Naomi's the first one to think about. She decides that she will return to Israel. A difficult decision, having forsaken her people, having forsaken her country, having left in that time of dire need.
leaving the famine-plagued land and going to Moab and being gone for more than 10 years, she'll now go back to Bethlehem because she understands that God has given. And I think there's three things that we see in the rest of this chapter that God gives. So if he took away these three lives, he gives at least three things in my reading of this chapter that we would be wise to note. And the first thing God gives is provision. Provision. You see it here. Verse 6. She arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, and Yahweh had visited his people in giving them food. To suffer a catastrophic loss, to see God's hand in judgment, in difficulty, in death, it's sometimes difficult to see at all any gift that he gives. But it is most appropriate that this first gift that's highlighted in this text is a most basic one. Through it all, through all the loss, through all the suffering, through three funerals in this short time period, God has visited his people with a blessing, and the famine is over. No famine comes that God has not ordained. No war begins that God is not behind. No drought commences without God's sovereign hand over it all. But no drought relents apart from the sovereign hand of God. And no famine turns to a time of feasting without a sovereign hand of God. And no period of peace begins apart from a sovereign hand of God. And so after this great loss, we see great gain. And though it's distant, it's not maybe even 100 miles away at minimum, she's able to go back to this land, and that's a gift from God. Psalm 111 says he gives them food. God's gift of food, of sustenance, is a perpetual reminder to his people that he cares for them and that he meets their needs. We are a culture and a people who obsess about food, but not this part of it. We obsess about the protein content in wheat, and we obsess about were these ingredients were they modified genetically? Because I only want trees that are scraggly and grow ugly fruit and weren't planted next to other trees that could pollinate them as God intended. Whatever. GMO. Let me tell you something. I'm an urban chicken farmer. This is a side note, but we're getting to provision. Urban chicken farmer. I go to the store the other day. I see a carton of eggs, right? I got eggs at my house. 17 this morning, just so you know. And I see a carton of eggs, and it says 100% vegetarian fed chicken eggs. And I go, pop! And I see the ladies at the store going, oh, the vegetarian fed chicken eggs. I'm making that part up. They weren't actually saying that, but people are buying these eggs because it's got like an earthy kind of container on it. Do you know why I have a problem with that? Because chickens aren't vegetarians, man. They're not going to get mad chicken disease. Chickens eat lizards. You should see. Come to my house. Watch my chickens eat lizards and giant bugs. Not vegetarians. Why do you want vegetarian fed eggs, weirdos? Sorry. So we obsess about food, don't we? We think about like, oh, we gotta get closer to the source of our food. And you know, you gotta connect with the chain that brings your food, and we don't wanna waste fossil fuels And we obsess about that part of our food, you know. It's a dietitian's approach to food, and that's all has a place, I'm sure. If you live, you know, longer than 120, call me. But here's where I wish we connected with our food. I wish it was a more biblical connection to our food. I wish we saw in something ordinary like food, God's provision. I think it's wise and good that Christian families pray before their meals. I heard a pastor once say, well, I don't want my kids to get into rote religiosity, so we don't pray before meals. We just eat. Where did that food come from? And I don't mean the supply. Like, was it grown in the Central Valley? Is it local? What I mean is, do you acknowledge that all your food, especially the genetically modified ones that actually have reversed hunger in large parts of the world, we won't get into it. So, do you acknowledge that your food, what you ate today or what you will eat today, I know it's dangerous to talk about lunch at 11:24, but what you will eat today is a gift from God's hand. That's fundamental. That provokes worship. Sunday night, I have this religious ritual you should know about, that when I get home from church with the fam, where there's a few rituals. One, the kids eat cereal every Sunday night, without exception, cereal. They love it. Sunday night, cereal night, it's on. And we let them have the worst kind of cereal, like Fruity Pebbles and stuff, because I was deprived of that stuff, and look at how I look. It's weird. Didn't work at all. So, no sugar cereal at my house growing up. Now, sugar cereal, Sunday nights. Woo! After the sugar cereal, put the kids to bed, there's a ritual I do. And it's called rolling out the trash. Because the garbage truck's coming on Monday. Monday morning, sometimes at 6 o'clock in the morning. If I skip this ritual, I'm in trouble all week. Because Dunkin's generate trash. There's a great number of us. And I roll out those three cans, those color-coded cans, and I usually obey the color coding. And as I roll out those cans, I'm reminded what they represent. They represent plenty. They do. Every one of those Sunday night rituals and whatever you do with your trash, if you haul it down from your dorm and throw it in a dumpster, or if someone comes and serves you and takes your trash away, what a life. Know that basura is evidence of God's kindness, that you have plenty. And so don't pass over this little word about Yahweh visiting his people and giving them food. And that solicits Naomi's decision to return to the land of Bethlehem, to Bethlehem of Judea, to the house of bread, because there's bread back. And it's the time of barley harvest. See God's hand in it. That's the first grain that would come in, probably April time of year. And so they come at this perfect time, a time of provision, and that's the first gift I see in this text is provision. But there's a second and even greater gift that I see in this text, highlighting God's sovereign, taking and giving, and the second thing he gives, let's call it conviction. Conviction. It's this argument she has with her daughters-in-law. And it's where we begin to see some of the play on her theology and on her name even. She says, return, each of you, that key word, return, go back. Return and go back to your mother's homes. You see, it was not a positive prospect for this widow to come back to the town that she left with two more widows. I mean, when the relatives come and do not leave, that's that kind of a situation. It's like this is taxing on the local economy. There is too many widows coming in. It's going to be very difficult for this town recuperating from the famine. Well, what are they going to do with these three? With no connections here, they're going to be an enormous burden to somebody, and two of them are foreigners. And foreigners are not welcome with open arms in Israel in most cases. And so Naomi knows that these girls who are still young, who still have, you know, their relative good looks, they can go and they can find a Moabite husband. Their father, their mother can arrange for them another marriage, which was necessary in their day for survival. See, it's reversed today. Today, marriage is necessary for male survival. I thought that was way funny. And so she tells them, go back to your mother's house. And she kisses them, and you see this affection, and you see her blessing on them. May Yahweh deal kindly with you. That's her name, kindness or pleasantness. Naomi is derived from that word. She wants God to bless them because she knows God has not blessed her. And she's well aware of the bitterness that she's experienced. And after some pleading and some reasoning and some arguing that there is no redeemer, the person in that culture who would rescue this situation by both right and obligation, he was to come in and bring one of these women into his house so that she was cared for and so that the lineage of the deceased husband would carry on. It was a big deal to them. It's hard for you to understand a lot of that, but that's part of getting to this world, is it was of critical importance that there was an inheritance. It was critical importance that this land had someone to care for it. It was of great significance that there was social welfare and security found in the family and not in a government provision back then. And so marriage was a necessity, and she knew it would be better for them to go back, better for them to go back to Moab, where they wouldn't be judged as ethnic difference. They wouldn't be seen as foreigners. They wouldn't be looked down upon racially as they may have been in Israel. And so she tells them to go back, and Orpah resists her somewhat, and there is no reason, just as there's no reason to judge what happens in the death of these men in the beginning, I don't think there's any reason to look down on Orpah for the decision she makes. The grass is greener in Moab by all accounts. Naomi's argument is a sound one, and so Orpah, she genuinely seems to love her mother-in-law, and it's acknowledged that these women treated their husband with kindness that was famous to their mother-in-law, and she wanted that kindness to be repaid by Yahweh. But Orpah makes a wise decision. Orpah makes a decision that would be the obvious one to make. She kissed Naomi goodbye, but Ruth refuses. And here's where the spotlight has gone from Naomi in returning to Orpah, and Naomi returning to her land, going back to Bethlehem, Orpah returning to Moab to find relief there and to see what happens to her. But Ruth, the central, increasingly central figure of this book, Ruth, we get to meet her. And I think the word to describe her is stubborn. She's so stubborn. She won't listen to logic. She won't listen to reason. She's directly disobeying her mother-in-law. She's taking a great risk that has been calculated before her. She's been shown this is not the way to go. There's no more husbands coming out of me. I'm going back to Israelite land. This is not the place for a Moabite woman. And Orpah hears it and heeds it, and Ruth hangs on to her and will not let her go. And it's here we see the second gift that God gives, and it's a gift of conviction. A stubborn, unshakable conviction that Ruth has in her to go against all conventional odds, to go against the obvious right opportunity, to turn her back on that, and in faith, in conviction, to cling on to Naomi, to not allow her to be alone, but to hang on to her, knowing that it might cost Ruth her life, and it might cost Naomi her life in this decision. But regardless of it, Ruth hangs on in stubbornness and faith and conviction. She hangs on knowing that this sovereign God, what does she know about this sovereign God in the days of Judges? We don't know. Were these people deeply God-fearing people? Meh. What had she seen Yahweh do thus far? Curse his own people in their land, kill the patriarch, and kill the husbands. That's what she knows about Yahweh from this story. I mean, you could say, well, you know, Naomi, she did way of the master. She was really witnessing to them the whole time, and you know, they had a testimony of Yahweh's faithfulness. I don't see it here. But I do see some inexplicable stubbornness and conviction in Ruth's faith, that she hangs on to her mother-in-law regardless of the outcome, regardless of the consequences. She clings to her and makes this famous statement that sort of works at weddings and sort of doesn't. Like barely does. I've used it at weddings. Do not urge me to leave you or return, to turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, my people. Your God, my God. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. Wow. Ruth, what are you doing? Where is this coming from? Where inside of Ruth does this make sense? How is this a good idea? And I think the answer is that it's not. And sometimes faith is like that. Hudson Taylor, the great missionary to China, I quote this all the time, but I'm usually talking about, like, should we have these street tacos or safer tacos? But I love this quote, and I just try to think about it all the time, and I want to live with it, and I want to wrestle with it. Hudson Taylor, the founder of China Inland Missions, who gave his life for the gospel to go to China, used to say, without an element of risk, without an element of risk in our exploits for God, there's no need for faith. Without an element of risk in our exploits for God, there's no need for faith. And that's how he justified his existence in China and the decisions he made that were counter-logical. That's how he justified decisions that could only be explained by a belief in the resurrection. And suddenly Ruth, who is only seen in this story, the very hard hand of Yahweh, expresses her commitment not only to her mother-in-law and to her mother-in-law's people whom she has never met, and to her mother-in-law's land that she's never been to, but she expresses an unwavering, unshakable, inexplicable commitment to her mother-in-law's God and calls him by name. And then invokes an oath. Thus may Yahweh do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me. I don't know that Ruth knows what she's getting into in saying a line like that. I don't know that she knows the story of Jephthah. They're in Moab, for goodness sakes. I think Ruth has this inexplicable faith because that's often how faith moves in its operating principle. It's against conventional wisdom. It's often against safety. Instead, it takes great risks for God and trusts God with the results. And so the second gift is conviction that would have her call on this God and trust that this God will not let her go. And so she clings to her mother-in-law. I love this story because of Ruth's unshakable faith. I love this story because of Ruth's inexplicable faith. And it's a reminder of Philippians 1:29 that faith is not something you conjure up with a pro and con list. It's not because the magazine's called Decision Today. Faith is a gift from God. And I see his sovereign hand in taking these three men's lives. And I see his sovereign hand in giving the land food again. And I see a sovereign hand in provoking the heart of Ruth to do that which could only be explained by the sovereign hand of God, provoking the heart of Ruth to take in faith something that is so far beyond her expectations and so far outside of the way she could even think about the possibilities. In fact, she asserts that what's probably going to happen as an end result of this faith-filled decision is that they'll both be buried together. She has no idea, does she? She has no idea what God has in store, because he's going to go so far beyond the little faith of the Moabitess woman and use that little bit of faith to move a mountain to bring Messiah. And I see a third gift here, and I'll just call it reception. And in it, we see Naomi's theology, and we see the people of Israel welcomes a strong word. I'm fine with reception, to receive them back again. Verse 19. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem, and it came about when they had come to Bethlehem, the house of bread, that all the city was stirred because of them. And the woman said, "Is this Naomi?" Probably an abbreviated name, lacking the name of God, often inserted into Hebrew names. This is a simplified version. Her name either meant in its fullest form, if it had a fullest form, and it probably did, her name probably meant woman of kindness or woman of pleasantness, or Yahweh is pleasant, Yahweh is kind. It's the word that is repeatedly used as a reference to God's central attribute of his loving kindness, his kindness, his pleasantness, his tenderness with his people. And she comes back to town, and the women say, the city is stirred to see this woman come back, bearing the weight of her loss on her face, undoubtedly having aged these many years. They didn't know what became of her, but now she enters into the town, and she says to them, when they ask, "Is this even the pleasant one?" She says, "Don't call me that anymore. Call me Mary or Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." It's a word that means he brought disaster, or he's marred me. And we don't know why. And she doesn't know why. But I see in this reception of these townspeople, I also see her reception of her circumstances unfold. And though Naomi is interpreting them in the worst possible light, God's judgment, his bringing disaster, his marring me, and she can't see out of this dark storm, she doesn't see the light breaking through at all, I see her receiving these circumstances, and she doesn't abandon God. She receives these things from God's hand, and they're hard things to receive. It's easy to receive blessing. It's easy to receive a new and better job. It's easy to receive the gift of children. It's easy to receive an easy and warm and fun marriage. It's easy to receive a financial blessing or benefit. Those things are easy to receive and easy to acknowledge God's hand in them, but she's not receiving that. She's receiving the hard things. She's receiving the death of those who are precious to her, and she doesn't curse God. She wrestles with him. She receives what's happening through God's sovereign hand, and she doesn't know how to exactly take it in, but she says, "He's been bitter with me." The Almighty, she calls him Shaddai, meaning the mighty one, the powerful one, has dealt very powerfully with me. He's brought disaster upon me. He's marred me. So don't call me pleasant, since Yahweh has witnessed against me, or a legal term meaning has testified against me. He has looked at my life, and this is Naomi's take on it, and I don't know if she's right, and I don't know if she's wrong, and she doesn't know if she's right, and she doesn't know if she's wrong, but she says, God has marred me, he's stricken me, and he's testified against me. But know that she doesn't say, I don't see God in it, it's all chance. And this is where, when you don't have the conviction, the blind and swerving conviction of Ruth, at least grab on to the reception of the sovereignty of God in Naomi. Because she sees in this circumstance God. And she sees it hard and difficult and painful, and she's complaining against him. But she doesn't say it's chance. She doesn't say it's fate. She doesn't say it's risk. She doesn't say, I'm not being rewarded for the things that I took into account. She's saying, God has turned his face on me. Do you recognize God's hand in those difficult things when he preserves your life, though he takes that which is dear to you? And you can look back on your life and see circumstances where you were spared. And I wonder how you think about it. One of the worst things I've ever seen in real life was when I was in junior high. We were having fun in New Mexico at a camp. And we were running down this gravel road, a bunch of us, you know, eighth graders or something. And there was some guys on horses. This is New Mexico, just deal with it. And one of the horses kind of got out of control, the guy riding it, and it was trying to come up behind us. We were having fun, and the horse ran into kind of us in this pack of kids, and one of the kids hit the ground, and the horse kind of stomped on his face, and the rest of us kind of scattered, and he was almost killed. But it looked worse than killed. I've never seen anything like that again or before. It was a gruesome wound, and he had, I think, countless surgeries after that. And it was hard. I mean, it was like at a summer camp. It was the first day of a summer camp. That's not usually how those go. And I remember thinking back on James, the kid that got stomped by this horse and disfigured by this horse. And trying to calculate within, you know, a 14, 13-year-old mind, what's God doing? But I look back now and realize that horse didn't trample and kill him, nor did it touch any one of us. And I don't know what God was doing there. But Naomi reminds me that God's doing something everywhere. And it's not for us to interpret it always. It's for us to receive it. And if your interpretation, like Naomi's, is dark and difficult, well, at least I hope you're holding on to God by faith. You're wrestling with him. At least she's talking to him, talking about him. She says, he's testified against me, but in doing, she's testifying about him. Shaddai's dealt very bitterly with me. She doesn't deny him. She doesn't forsake him. She struggles with this. Can you accept only good news from God? Or can you accept bad news and wrestle with it? Does our pursuit of comfort and ease make it so that we can only acknowledge blessings from God? That makes you no different than a prosperity preacher on TV. God brings those tears into your life. And Revelation 21:4 reminds us that someday he will wipe them away from your face. God's in it. Ruth won't be pressured to abandon her mother-in-law because of her unexplainable faith and commitment that has no logical reason, to cling to a widow's destructive poverty and add to it even. No social reason, only ethnic rejection before them, and so they walk back into town. Naomi, the bitter one, but both of them mingled with faith. Naomi, honest, not optimistic. She's seen difficulty because she's seen the Lord take, and now she's seeing the Lord give. But she hasn't read chapter 2 and 3 and 4 yet. And she has no idea that when God gives, his giving is far beyond our own lifespan and our own expectations. And in his giving, he can give life not only to us, but to the nations. And so we don't see King David yet, neither does she. But we see King Jesus on the horizon of this story as God works out these microcosmic details to accomplish his global good so that we too would see God take and experience God give and respond to him in faith and take risks knowing that he rewards those who believe in him. God, thank you for your word. It's a message that we know that we need to hear. And whether those here with us today are contending with difficulty, who've suffered loss, God, I pray that as they wrestle with you, they receive the comfort that only you can provide. And God, all of us have loss in the horizon. All of us are going to experience life in a sin-drenched world, a doomed world. But we hope against all odds, against logic, against our limited historical perspective. And we cling to you, O God, knowing that if you can bring King David out of this situation in Moab, and if out of King David you can bring King Jesus, then we're all in. Take us, God, for pain, for loss, for the gospel's sake, and do with us what you would see fit to accomplish your purposes, your unstoppable purposes, and to bring about us true and genuine worship when we see this tangled mess of life to be an intricately woven tapestry, all according to your sovereign plan. In the matchless name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.